Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Stephen Hart, the author of Au Naturel, Naturism, Nudism, and Tourism in 20th Century France, and the book was published by Louisiana State University Press in 2014. Hi there, Steve.
Hi, Roxane.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for interviewing me.
I wonder if you could get us started by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and what got you interested in working on France.
Sure. I'm one of those great examples of somebody who started not knowing anything about France, which I guess is all of us at some point. But I started taking French in college because I wanted to figure out what all those French words in the 19th century novels I'd been reading in high school were supposed to mean. And I happened to land in a beginning, you know, really French 101 class with Janina Traxler, and she's a fabulous professor. And by the time I graduated, I had majored in French as well as history and actually did master's work in both as a result of the experience.
Mm-hmm. And what got you interested in the subject of this book in particular?
I had taken German and Danish in graduate school, and there was a couple of mentions in the course of the semester about widespread nudism in along Danish beaches and in northern Germany. And then as I was doing dissertation research in Alsace in the early 1990s, I did a lot of bike riding, and I came across what I later found out was one of the earliest of the Naturiste sites that was established in Alsace, at least in the modern period. I'd talk with people, and I kept getting, you know, sporadic references. So I sort of pulled those together when I finished a different project and thought, you know, there must be more to this. And the more I read, the more I learned, and the more interesting it got. And like a lot of things we do, it resulted in a book.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to start, Steve, by asking you a question about your note on usage. It's not usually a question I ask authors, but at the very beginning of the book, it's quite entertaining, your note on usage, maybe the most entertaining one I've ever read. And it gets at some of the terms you use in the book and at some of the issues that are at stake in this history that you're exploring. And in it, you talk about the relationship between these different terms, naturism and nudism, and the way that those terms are or aren't used in French. And I wondered if you could just say a few words about that.
Yes, of course. I mean, the wonderful thing about cultural history is it's attuned us all into analyzing the simplest of words and thinking about, you know, the various meanings embedded. And, you know, in this case, it starts with the title of the book. Au naturel is not an expression in France that has anything to do with nudism. It basically means unseasoned, like if you buy thon au naturel, you're buying unseasoned tuna.
Mm-hmm.
And then it involves the simple word naturisme, which basically means nudism in France. And that is a result of some of the changes that I describe in the book, a way of making nudism palatable after World War II by emphasizing its natural qualities. But of course, it means something to Anglo-American speakers, but not much in France. And then there are simple terms that I think have to be described and are say something about the historical reality. So one of those that I have to describe at the beginning is snip. Looks like the English word slip.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not a women's undergarment. It, in France, it means kind of a brief underwear, male or female. And, you know, I could have translated as Speedo, but Speedo of course, a brand name, and mm-hmm. it's a later phenomenon. So brief, you know, as you're thinking about, you know, male tidy whiteys, you know. So I went ahead and described that I'm going to use the term sleep, and then I go ahead and put it in the text. So I'm glad you liked it. And it was, like the rest of the book, fun to write. But in this case, I thought it was really necessary to hit some of the key terms at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And so those words, naturism, nudism, what's the distinction between those two?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it morphs constantly over time. So in the interwar years and then after 1945 in French, nudism is a little harsher. To get to that harshness today, you'd have to go to a term like apoilisme, as in the term apoil, you know, down to the hair or down to the skin. And So naturism sounded more palatable. It emphasizes the natural. But then in English, the temptation would be to say, I would be tempted to say that nudism is basically naturism. And on the most simple level, we could translate it directly. But then naturism exists. And for a while, in the interwar years, meant something. I'm relying on Brian Hoffman's dissertation for this and his forthcoming book, which is just going to be excellent. Naturism could mean more natural as compared to nudism. But that shifts, according to him, and I think he's absolutely right, by the 1990s, where nudism became palatable and naturism implied something that was a little bit more sexual than nudism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like so many terms, they vary massively over time. And, you know, the great thing about history is that we try to nail down what somebody or what a series of people meant at a given point in time, because it usually reveals deeper meanings.
Mm-hmm. You make the point early on in the introduction, and you come back to this throughout the book, Steve, that the exposure of the body and the sexualization of the body are not the same thing. And I wanted to ask you about that, and as well to ask you about the role that, about your theoretical framework and how you're approaching the question of sexuality throughout the book, including the references that you make to Michel Foucault's history of sexuality. And I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how Foucault is working for you, how you see the book as in dialogue with and perhaps a type of history of sexuality.
Yes, of course. The most salient fact, and here I'm describing the broader book project, is mm-hmm. that for many of the naturistes, they insisted, and very often I would take them at their word, that nudism is not necessarily sexual. And the kind of way that I could help to make that argument for them would be to point out, you know, if you go to the doctor, it's for most people, not a very sexualized experience. So in that particular context, nudism does not have a connection to sexuality. And they say that it doesn't need to, that in fact it doesn't. Now, you know, in other cultural contexts, people do draw the distinction. But Foucault became very helpful for me in that he doesn't assume either a liberation that occurs in the earlier period, you know, when we usually talk about Foucault and the shift from the 18th into the 19th century, nor a later shift after World War II. The notion of liberation is way too big. It tries to do too much. It's got too many connections. Because a more exposed body is not necessarily a more liberated one. And an example I could give from early naturist camps would be, and this came from Madame Lecoq, who was the spouse of one of the founders of the movement, at least after 1945, that in the interwar years, for a couple, a man and a woman, to hold hands in certain camps would have been considered too sexual. So, you know, you can take your clothes off, but you may not even hold hands because that might be indicating something else, or where eye contact takes place. You know, if people are clothed, eyes could easily wander a little bit as long as they don't stare at certain body parts. But that would become a much more fraught practice, sort of eyes wandering in one of the early nudist camps. So on the one hand, you could say that it's liberation, but on the other, it may mean more rules or different rules. And I'm with Foucault in thinking that he doesn't exactly say it this way. We all take liberties with theorists. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there's kind of a way that people make their own codes, certain rules in certain places, in certain groups. We like to figure out what the rules of the game are. And so as the body became more exposed, for some it became more sexualized, particularly if you're thinking about commercial expressions, you know, since the 1970s in France and elsewhere. But for many, it didn't. It depends.
You say that after World War II, France became the foremost nudist tourist destination in Europe. So I have a few questions about this. I mean, the book goes from the interwar years to the mid-70s, really. So I wanted to ask you about that chronological framework. And then, you know, why does France become the foremost nudist tourist destination in Europe after World War II. So in the middle, that happens. So yeah, those two questions.
Yes, of course. With the timeline, I wanted to start in 1927 because that's when the first major figures that I introduce into the book first championed nudism in France. So those would be the Durville brothers and Marcel Quiéné de Monjou. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens they both championed the practice in 1927. One, the Durville took a little different route. Quiéné de Monjou will continue to champion it in mixed sex and nudism in groups in the late 1920s and 1930s. It had been a practice, of course, already in Germany from the turn of the century on. In the early years, actually, the French proponents would mention the German example, beginning in, just coincidentally, the spring of 1933, particularly as the Nazis were consolidating power, they'll deny that there's any kind of linkage or that there was a German model for it. That's pretty transparent, I think. But I wanted to start when there was this organized advocacy and practices in groups. It doesn't mean that there wasn't what, you know, Americans call skinny. And when I say North Americans, I always mean North Americans, mm-hmm. and Canadians. Americans call skinny dipping certainly occurred probably for centuries. We've got evidence of regulation in various areas that became bourgeois resorts in the 19th century. It's definitely a practice. And then it could have a political and social message among the libertaires, the people who we probably call libertarian socialists, anarchists, but not necessarily people who are blowing up things. So the sort of reformist embracing of certain utopian notions, mm-hmm. Referred to as naturiste in early 20th century France. And I really wanted to not deal with the 19th century phenomenon because Arnaud Bourbereau has done a terrific book in which he handles that very well. But at the point that literally it became nudism. And then for the other, you asked about both bookends. For the second of the bookends, I chose the early 1970s because there was an international nudist conference. It was actually held at Cap d'Agde, one of the sites that known for that. In fact, the site where they're not only known for nudism, but the largest installation, more visitors to this day than elsewhere. And that had become kind of an urban installation with several story apartment buildings, cement everywhere. And ironically, at the meeting in 1974, they decided that they were about environmentalism, which in some way was like a return to the roots of the movement. And it's ironic that it's occurring in a cemented in installation. Was accompanied by another of the installations was called Montalivet over on the Aquitaine coast. And a second major camp was developed there, welcoming, you know, up to 20,000 people, called Euronat. That opened at about the same time. So it shows a level of legitimacy, a state stamp of approval on the movement. Mm-hmm. But then finally, you know, I think historians of modern France would agree, even though we have a hard time putting our finger on it, something important shifted in France. We like to think of it as being 1968. Mm-hmm. We know that the calls that culminated in the events of spring of 1968 were, you know, that was already occurring. And it occurred afterwards. So there is what is sometimes referred to as a liberation again. I mean, it's funny how people have to keep being liberated and it means something different over time.
Right.
A kind of a liberation of mores. I don't know. I mean, in some ways it's liberating. In other ways, it is just a shift. There's more openness about practices that have been widespread since the beginning of humankind. Mm-hmm. So as compared to the 19th century, there may be more explicit references and admission of what's going on. In some cases in France, it's actually, I think, the influence of the power of social sciences. You know, social scientists say, let's examine a practice without judging it first, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, a more traditionally moralistic approach, which, you know, is widespread still in the U.S. on a lot of issues, that says we don't think people should do it. Therefore, we're going to have to keep people from doing it. And so something shifted in the late 60s and early 1970s. I thought it was easier because of that conference and the opening of Roanoke to pin it down to 1974. Sometime in that period of the late 60s and 1970s. And, you know, that's the beauty of an epilogue, because they allow us to kind of fill it in and, develop it. And we don't have to be, we're not under the same constraints of saying, you know, well, it's definitely this year or that year, because some of these phenomena, like, you know, how people take off their clothes on beaches, is pretty fluid, particularly in the 1970s.
And so why is this a French phenomenon?
Oh, yeah, the second part of your question. It's a very good question. I don't want to oversimplify, but these are practices that were not in the interwar years or in the 1950s or 1960s permissible in those other places that Northern Europeans like to go, Italy and Spain. And there'll be developments in what is today Croatia, you know, on the Yugoslavian coast. But the primary magnet was France. Because France, in various ways, permitted it, particularly after 1945. I start the book with a quote by a German from 1963, in which he describes France has it all. You know, it's got oceans, it's got the Atlantic, it's got the Mediterranean, it's got mountains, it's got joie de vivre, it's got a certain live and let live, kind of a notion of liberty. And know, while maybe he's exaggerating a little bit, there is a sense for a lot of the Northern Europeans, particularly the Germans, which make up the largest numbers, that France was offering kind of a relaxation, an approach that was somewhat less rigid than they expected. Sometimes they'll even say words like liberty, democracy. And, you know, it's in a vague way. So I don't want to exaggerate it. But France had the climate, not quite Spain or Italy, but in the summer, it's quite warm. And it had, according to many Northern Europeans, this sense of, you know, people aren't going to bug you, kind of a looseness about practices. And whether France was a particularly loose place or not, their presence and the fact that they brought hard currency meant that French nudists, who of course had been around since the interwar years, could use that interest on the part of international visitors to press for legitimacy. And they do it at the municipal level. Municipalities see that they can gain, because these are inevitably out of the way places. There's no reason for, I don't know, Nice to bother. I mean, they have plenty of tourists already, but some of these out of the way places are very interested. And they can use it, the local nudists, I mean, the French nudists can use it, and some people who are actually based in these communities can use it to argue that they need accommodation. And municipalities work with the prefects, and it really happens on the ground in a very case-by-case, here and there, very direct kind of way that ultimately by the 1960s gets integrated into these plans to remake the French coast, first in Languedoc-Roussillon and then in Aquitaine, to make them magnets for international and domestic French tourists.
So, I mean, of course, the book is focused on France, but you also make the point in the introduction, and you kind of carry this throughout, that this is a transnational history, and that one of the things that distinguishes the book from previous work on these movements and activities is that work has tended to be, the historiography has tended to be national. So what can you tell us about that, about how this book is a transnational history of nudism?
Yes. You're absolutely right. I do make the argument that we've tended to see this as national. There's very little literature on nudism in historical literature on nudism in France. You could get the impression from it that there wasn't much going on. Quite a bit more on Germany. And of course, it was a more important phenomenon in Germany, but it also caught scholars' eyes sooner in terms of projects. About half of the nudists who came to France in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and up to the present are international, that is outside of France. Today we might say they're European because that's where most of them were coming from. At the time, until, you know, the European Union really took form and increasingly could argue for something like a European identity, they were simply referred to as foreigners. And they, it's a movement of people, like some of the studies that have appeared in the last 10 years on immigration or migration, that can be traced through transnational history. And, you know, that we have a tendency among historians to, thankfully, kind of poo-poo new faddish words. We're not big fans of neologisms. But I think transnationalism's got something going for it. Judiciously used, it allows us to capture realities that we could tend to want to beat into the form of national histories, this or that. You know, there's an earlier predecessor to transnational history, comparative history. My dissertation and first book were in the field of comparative history. There was a way that was very much tracing developments in two different national contexts. And sometimes, I mean, there's really superb work, but sometimes it could seem a little bit like, you know, this country has apples and this other country also has fruit and there are oranges. And this is what an apple looks like, and this is what an orange looks like. And, you know, we made some important contributions with that model, but it didn't allow us to deal as much with a transnational movement of people and to track particularly their own constructions of identity as mm-hmm. they were moving in different parts of the world.
The first top couple of chapters of the book, Steve, focus on this interwar period, and you talk about the D'Urville brothers and Marcel Kinney de Mongeau. And I guess I want to start by asking you, just sort of in general about the interwar years, whether you see the, maybe it's, I'm thinking about this because of the centenary of the beginning of World War One, that, you know, is what happens in the history of nudism in the interwar years a legacy of World War One?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, it's always hard for historians because we imply causation by talking about one thing after another. Since I'm talking about 1927, you know, sometimes I think that, you know, World War One was the Great War at the time. I didn't realize World War II was coming. You know, the Great War may have had an influence in the way that, as you yourself know through your own work, in imagining the future, in mm-hmm. laying out certain ways of improving the body of society, both in the collective, but also in the very narrow and individual sense. But then in this case, in the case of nudism, one of the things I find remarkable is that, you know, the D'Urville brothers are very much about, you know, eating properly and getting plenty of exercise. And they're talking constantly about bodies and improvement of bodies. But you would go through their interwar publications, and same is true of Kinney de Mongeau, looking for any sign that there were severely maimed bodies in their society. And it's just not there. So at the same time that we'll call them your guys are developing prosthetics, my guys are completely ignoring them. Mm. And so there's a sense that, you know, the World War, you know, may have had an impact. But if we look at the long-term continuities, at the Libertaire, we're already pushing the envelope before 1945. Things were developing in Germany already before 1945, I meant before 1914. Mm-hmm. Nudism was developing in Germany before 1914. I'm reluctant to attribute the changes necessarily to the Great War. Certainly, the interwar years, the 30s as much as the 20s, were a period of much change in how the world was perceived. You know, there's a great deal of ideological shifting that was going on. And certainly, we'll call them my guys, were reflecting many of those broader discussions that were happening in society.
Mm-hmm. And so to sort of focus on your guys in this period. What's the difference between them? I mean, what's the spectrum of nudism in the interwar years? And, you know, if you can tell us about the Durville brothers and Quiénet de Monjeau, how do they represent different aspects of this movement and these activities?
Yes, yeah, so they make kind of a nice contrast. The Durville brothers, because, you know, they're starting at approximately the same time, and the Durville brothers were doctors. And this is a period when the allopathic model had not yet really become dominant. You know, so these guys are pretty close to some homeopathic doctors that I know today. Mm. And, you know, the organism had to be kept in balance. It wasn't about, you know, treating a part, but instead treating the whole. And so their vision is very prescriptive. You know, you should eat these things. They have long lists of things you can eat, things you can't eat, how much exercise you should get, how you should sleep, you know, with the window open. And they embrace in 1927 nude exercise in groups, mixed sex groups as well. They quickly back away from it because they get a pushback from the prefect of police of Paris, who had authorization over an area that they had wanted to set up a camp out in the department of Seine-et-Oise. And they, as doctors, and it's very prosperous ones, actually, you know, from their residences, they lived out in the 16th arrondissement where, you know, all these rich Americans were running around in the interwar years. And they opted for acceptability. So in the end, they argued that men should be wearing slip and women should be wearing slip and what they called cache-seins, so kind of a bra or a halter top. And that was in public, but then in private, I've seen video of a film that was made on their installation, the Ile de Levant down in the Mediterranean. Certainly were practicing nudism, and accounts of people who had contact with the Durville recognized that that's exactly where they thought things would go, but they weren't willing to push for social change. They reflected the society they were in and the ambiguities as much as anything. By contrast, Quiénet de Monjeau, so if the Durville were the good cops, Quiénet de Monjeau was the bad cop, and he embraced the movement. After one publication was closed down, he launched another one. When it was closed down, and the way this would be closed down usually is the prefect of police of Paris and the other municipal police forces would refuse to allow the journal to be displayed, affiché in French, in the kiosk or in the, you know, sort of tobacco and press stores that were everywhere. And that was the death knell of a publication in a country where most of these things were purchased and were not by subscription, as would have been the case in the U.S. at the time. Mm-hmm. So they, Quiénet de Monjeau really pushes the argument. He establishes an elite installation where, an elite place where people can practice, and really does not yield an inch. And therefore has a series of court battles as well as these skirmishes with the police. So they represent two, by having the two groups, that is the Durville brothers on the one hand and Quiénet de Monjeau and the people, his collaborators, on the other, there is a way that their experience allows me in the book to clarify, elucidate, to pull apart some of the various developments that were happening in the movement during that period.
So what did the war change? What did the war do? The Second World War, I should say.
Yes.
You know, and how did nudism and its history intersect with some of the things that we, you know, typically associate with the post-war period, you know, the rise of consumer culture, changes in the nature of, you know, work and the economy and all of these kinds of things? What's the connection there between the history that you're exploring in the book and the watershed moment that is World War II?
I mean, there's something really very funny about it. You mentioned consumer culture, about nudism as a practice, because it, in a sense, it's a microcosm of tourism or leisure itself. I mean, you have to have a certain level of economic productivity to be able to afford to not do anything, or for some people to be able to afford to not be doing something constantly. So it takes a certain amount of wealth. It takes an already relatively prosperous society, ironically, because it doesn't take clothing, mm-hmm. but in France often takes travel, which is expensive, and it takes leisure. And even though, you know, the Fonds Populaire gave everyone, we all know, 2 weeks of paid vacation, that doesn't amount to much if you can't afford to get to one of the places where it's legal to practice. Or if you've got, or if you're a farmer and you don't yet have those 2 weeks of paid vacation. But to your question about what happened, what was the role of World War II? And there, I think there's an even weaker argument to be made for the impact of the war on post-war practice, in that nudism did not exist in an organized way during the Second World War. And it's really remarkable because it did in Germany. Contrary to some of the early scholarship, we now know that German groups that were not affiliated with the Social Democrats, which actually, you know, the majority of nudists in the 1920s were Social Democrats, but for the bourgeois groups, the more centrist and right-wing part of the political spectrum, they in essence were merged into Nazi organizations. It basically became, I'm oversimplifying and saying Nazi nudist groups, but they were. And the early 1940s, legislation was established in Germany that made them completely acceptable. And it's one of those great examples because it reminds us again, like in so many other cases, that Vichy was French. It was not an imposition of the Germans. And many of the prefects in southern France, in the areas not occupied by German troops till 1942, and that had prefects appointed by Vichy. So there's no way that you can say there was another German influence operating behind the scenes, influencing the prefects, were quite adamant that no nudism would exist and undertook efforts that didn't exist in the same way in Germany, and they had nothing to do with the politics of the groups. So the movement really had to reconstitute itself, and after the Second World War. So if the war had a major impact, it would be in the sense that the groups either had the burden or the opportunity to reconstitute themselves and to figure out how they were going to justify their practices, how they were going to make all of this work. So there's a new leadership after 1945, even though it came from the ranks of the people involved in the movement in the interwar years.
So the last sort of the second half of the book, Steve, is really focused on, it's not that you don't talk about places in France in the first couple of chapters, but in the second part of the book, you really focus on these three sites, L'Île du Levant, Montalivet, and Cap d'Agde. So I wanted to just ask you to give kind of a locations for all of these places. Yes. And then I guess I have a question about the extent to which, you know, the book is a history of these practices and of tourism and movement of people. But insofar as you're interested in place and these natural spaces, would you say that the book contributes to something we might call an environmental history?
Yeah, you ask good questions. I'm lucky in that the organization of a book comes for most of us, I think, from the material that we're dealing with. And I was fortunate that the Durville brothers established what's all called in English, a nudist colony on the Île du Levant, which is in the Mediterranean, off the coast of Hyères or Levant d'Eau, down off of the it's part of the department of the Var, off the coast there. And they did that in the interwar years, but it really thrived after World War II. So I could use that as a transition to move from these earlier groups that had installations that were quite small, with the individuals, to the chapter three, talking about the Île du Levant that had been of the Durville brothers, and then Montalivet, which is a creation of Albert Lecoq. And then by the time we get to Cap d'Agde, I can't point to an individual who was particularly important. So you're right, the book kind of shifts over its course from focusing on individuals to places, even though they're places earlier and they're individuals later.
Sure.
It was nice that that middle chapter, chapter three, allowed me to make that transition that didn't do violence to chronology, or frankly, the facts. So in the second part of the book, as you point out, I deal with the Ile de Levant, and that was an area, like I said, that the Derville brothers established in the 30s that began welcoming large numbers of nudists, up to 30,000 in the early 1950s, on a relatively small space, particularly as the French Navy was taking over big chunks, most of the island, for missile tests projectile tests in the late 1950s. And of course, wherever there's a conflict, a difference of opinion about how a space is going to be used, that leaves a nice paper trail. So the municipality of Hyères, which had control over, was part of the commune, the municipality of Hyères, had control over the Ile de Levant, wanted to preserve this as a space for nude practices, and therefore fought pretty hard with other French authorities, including the French Navy, to preserve. And then the fourth chapter deals with Albert Lecoq, but as part of it, focuses on Montalivet, which is on the Aquitaine coast to the northwest of Bordeaux, in the commune and the municipality of Vendée-Montalivet. And there, some of the same practices occurred. It's anybody who's seen the Aquitaine beaches are these huge expanses of sand. And at the time, there were very few people there. While there was a bit of an infrastructure, because, of course, that's where the German Atlantic Wall had been built during World War II. So Montalivet, ironically enough, which would be welcoming a fair number of Germans in the 1950s and after, profited from the fact that the cement road that ran to it, the paved road that ran to it, was built by the Germans as part of fortifications. And in fact, all along that coast, you can still see the blockhouses that increasingly are falling into the sea. I was very lucky that the press was generous with illustrations as well as maps. So I actually have a picture of one of those blockhouses that's now toppled over as the beach is being eroded. And then the fifth of these spaces, Cap d'Agde, really came into its own, was founded in the late 50s, but really came into its own in the 1960s, in particular the 1970s. And whereas the Ile de Levant was barely developed, Montalivet was very much a sort of organization and Lecoq-controlled camp. Cap d'Agde was in a space that the French government decided in the 1960s needed to be remade to welcome tourists. And Rosemary Wakeman and Ellen Furlow have done terrific work on and others have done terrific work on the remaking of that coast. But there was already a nudist camp there. So there's a very interesting discussion that takes place within it's called the Racine mission. So it's got one of those long, aménagement du territoire, d'Occoussillon. I'm sure I'm forgetting a couple of nouns there. And it just got shorthanded as, the Racine mission. But there's a long discussion that goes on about, should we allow this to happen? And of course, the guys who ran it, the Ultra brothers, and large numbers of international nudists got involved to argue that, of course, the French state should. These are people who spend a lot of money, more than the average tourist. They tend to come in the off-season because, as we both know very well, most French families are on vacation from, right after the first week of July when the kids are out of school and up to about the 1st of September. These international tourists, sometimes older, sometimes younger, would come before that high season and they'd stay afterwards. So it was very lucrative for the municipality. And in the end, the French state not only agreed to Cap d'Agde becoming a portion of this redeveloped coast with state support, a portion of that remaining nudist, and in fact being developed as nudist, the so-called quartier naturiste at Cap d'Agde, but then took the same model or a comparable model and used it on the Aquitaine coast for sponsorship of the creation of Euronaut that I referred to earlier. That happened more in the early 1970s. So Languedoc was developed earlier. But again, these three places are all, it's a comparable development. And of course, nudists, international and French, are comparing the places all the time, trying to use arguments about what's practiced elsewhere to justify what should be done, what they'd like to have done where they are. But because each one is a little bit different, they allow me to take apart the assumptions that are built into it, how the decisions are getting made. It just becomes richer because mm-hmm. I'm able to deal with these three different places. And then the other part of your great question was, is this environmental history in addition to everything else? And that's a very good question. I'm glad that you see it that way. I had a student who has done a lot of work in geography, and what she said is that in geography, we call this a history of spaces. Mm. And that's what the environment is, after all. So I guess my answer to your question is yes. It is a history of spaces, uses of spaces, how people legitimate why they should use the space and how they should use the space. And any, whenever possible, of course, if there's a conflict over the usage of this space, that provides a rich domain for us as historians to explore what's taken for granted on both sides of the argument, but also what the agendas are of people who are trying to argue for their particular usage of this little piece of the environment.
Well, and it does seem like the figures that you're talking about and the history that you're exploring, at least in the post-war period, before even, are engaged in the question of what the natural is, right? For in a physical environment, surrounding physical environment, but also for human beings. And this sort of makes me want to ask you more about this figure, Albert Lecoq, who becomes this primary advocate in France of nudism. Mm-hmm. And particularly, you know, as you were talking about who these people are and where they're coming from, the idea that Lecoq, you know, drew on and used in his sort of advocacy, ideas about psychology, child development, sexuality, this idea of a kind of healthy human being. And I wanted to ask you to say more about that, what his shift is in terms of, you know, from earlier figures who are advocates of nudism, what does Lecoq bring to the discourse of nudism and to the movement?
Yes, one of his admirers referred to him as a manager. And in many respects, that was his gift. He wasn't that much of an innovator. What he figured out was to take the health-oriented agenda of the Derville brothers, who, after all, were doctors, and to use that to argue for the social acceptability of out-and-out nudism. So when he used the term naturism, he's really the one that used the term naturism to mean nudism and other stuff. And yet, if you think about it, he was, in arguing that people should be nude, he was really following publicly the agenda of Quienet de Mongeau. And some of the ideas, not all of them, but some of the ideas in Quienet de Mongeau's circle about the preference of nudism for maintenance of health, but also for a psychological, as you point out, a psychological health. So Lecoq argued that nudism was ipso facto sex ed, that there would not be a problem for young people if they grew up in a naturist environment in adolescence and in their 1920s, because after all, there wouldn't be a fake mystery. Nudism had after all been separated from sexuality, and that would be healthy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, all of this stuff is ironic. I mean, all of life is ironic if you think about it. Just as Cup Dogged was a cemented in apartment installation where people were saying that they were getting back to nature, or Montalivet had 15,000 people in very close proximity, thousands on the beach at once, in relatively close quarters, who had to use a fair amount of energy, meaning fossil fuel, to get themselves there, and where there would have to be a built-up infrastructure in order to take care of human waste and the provisioning of food and all that kind of stuff. Similarly, there's a fundamental irony built into Lecoq arguing that that sex ed would just occur if people saw new bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And that it would necessarily lead to psychological health. In some ways, it's kind of the opposite of the argument. And these are the people he was arguing against. And it's opposite of the argument that any nudity must be bad because it will lead to sex. You know, the arguments of his critics. And he really didn't define it any further. He and other mainstream naturistes after 1945 really avoided conversation of sexuality beyond there won't be problems of sexuality if you do what we say. That is, if you go to nudist groups and you follow the rules of the camps. Mm-hmm. By the late 1960s, and I don't think there's any coincidence at all, before 1968 and after 1968, right before he died in 1969, he argued that sexuality was all along the elephant in the room, and that young people in the late 1960s in France who were saying, we need to be more open about how this works, in what ways is nudism supposed to promote psychological health. To give you an example, in the 1930s, Kiani de Mongeau argued that if there was an exposure of young people to nude bodies, then the boys would not masturbate. And if they didn't masturbate, then they wouldn't become invertis or homosexuals. And if they didn't become homosexuals, they wouldn't get VD. Now, I recognize that those three things, there's no linkage in our minds, but there were linkages made regularly in the interwar years, as Carolyn Dean's book has pointed out. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of repeats that after 1945, to the extent that he comments on it at all. And then by the late 1960s is saying, no. We need to rethink these positions. Let's have a conversation. And to a large extent, the mainstream organization never had that conversation. Or when it did in the 70s and 80s, it fractured over it. Once they were successful, that is, there's widespread nudism, it's socially acceptable, there wasn't a reason for people to hew to groups, and they really didn't have to find arguments for justifying what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. You say at a certain point in the book, Steve, that there was a social, and you know what you just said made me think of this again, and a sexual conservatism to nudism, particularly in the 1950s, and I think that might not seem intuitive to most people. So what you were just saying about, I mean, is it strictly speaking a defensive posture, or can we really see in some strange way, or maybe not so strange way, that nudism reflects some of the things that we might, in a kind of global Western way, associate with the 50s and the conformism of the 50s and the conservatism, moral conservatism of the 50s. Does nudism actually express that rather than some liberation?
Yeah, I think you're right that it does. I'm amazed in looking at the longer, I don't want to say longue durée, you know, because we're really not talking, the analyste meant very long periods when they use that term, but a longer duration of history that embraces the interwar years and the postwar years, because I continue, when I'm looking at both in sort of the same framework of analysis, to be surprised by, despite knowing about the 1950s all along, but I'm surprised in many ways by how socially conservative the 50s were compared with the 30s as well as the 20s. And I think that the naturistes are reflecting that broader sort of zeitgeist of the 1950s. And, you know, there's a strategy on Lecoq's part. He certainly doesn't want to do too much that is going to condemn the movement in the eyes of most people, not because he wouldn't be able to figure out how to take his pants off, but because the movement would not be able to grow. From everything that I've read, he earnestly believed that people would be better off. And, you know, sometimes there are proclamations of world peace and everything else, but people would be better off if they practiced what he preached. And so I think that he believed it. He avoided those conversations about sexuality in the sort of, you know, sub rosa discussions that occurred and conversations I've had with people in the movement. I've been given no indication that, you know, Lecoq was using the movement in any way for, you know, spouse swapping or anything else. He appears to have really believed the agenda he set out. But as a manager, he noticed that society was changing in the late 1960s, and argued that if the movement was going to be successful, it had to change as society was changing. So, given that shift in the 60s, I think you're right. His strategy in the 1950s was to do something that was very comparable in a context where he didn't see a better way to proceed. So, ironically enough, he was not arguing that there was any particular liberation. He'd sometimes used the term, as many naturists did, of liberty, liberté. But often it was put in kind of a democratic format. You know, we should be allowed to do what we want to do that does not harm other people, kind of a classic definition of liberalism.
Mm-hmm. Well, this, you know, easily leads me to my next set of questions, which is about the state. You know, you've mentioned a couple of times what the state had an interest in terms of developing tourism and other things. And so where does the French state, French legislation, French politics fit into all of this? And, you know, what was political, if anything, about nudism in France?
Sure. You've probably figured out from the book and our conversation, like most historians of France, I'm a very serious Francophile. And one of the things I love most about France is the gap between en principe and en réalité.
You know? Right.
So you know, what's in principle and what's in reality? And en principe, nudism was presumably illegal in France. There was an article in the criminal code, article 330, that was against gross indecency, would be how we would translate, you know, outrage public à la pudeur. And that remained on the books until the 1990s, when it was replaced by something equally sort of broad that you could read about anything into. But because it was broad, it had to be interpreted. And we have a tendency to think of France as a place that had the Roman law tradition of codes without jurisprudence. And it's just not true. Just as there are law codes in, you know, the U.S. or in Canada, and there are laws in Britain, too. It's not just precedent. There are laws and then jurisprudence. So even if you accept that assumption of a Roman law model, nevertheless, there's a significant amount of jurisprudence. And so as issues arose, not only did municipalities have to decide what they were going to prosecute or who they were going to arrest and who they were going to try to prosecute, en réalité, as opposed to, you know, in principle, but judges have to figure out how to apply the law. And what it meant was that over time, the law got applied differently in different municipalities. In places that did not have problems attracting tourists and where there were large numbers of people, there was no move to change how Article 330 was read. But in areas that didn't have that kind of presence, municipalities argued for not only on the level of what they enforced and they didn't enforce, but in cases of problems, argued for a different approach. So this is one of those cases where, you know, while we may think of France as being a very centralized state, which of course it was and to a large extent still is, nevertheless, there's a fair amount of local variation, sometimes under the radar of the prefects, in other cases known by the prefects. So there's a difference among municipalities and there's a difference in different departments, depending on how the prefects interpreted the law.
Well, Steve, you know, the book, we talked about this already, the fact that the book sort of ends in the mid-1970s. And I just wondered if, you know, what your thoughts might be on, well, the legacies of this into the 80s, 90s, and then even up into the contemporary period. You know, do you see issues in contemporary France, whether to do with tourism or the body or sexuality, that reflect this history that you explore in the book?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's so much going on, I hesitate to respond because it's almost as though I'm going to be blocking out other things that are occurring. I have to say that I continue to be amazed that starting usually in about May, media reports in France in the local and national press and in broadcasting will inevitably have to have a series of stories about nudism. And as you might expect as a North American, you know, it's sort of titillating as well as a factual approach to the whole thing. So I don't think that most French people, even though there's much more widespread, and we think that, you know, up to 1.5 million people practice nudism in some form or another in France today, that it still does not sometimes, or in the case of many people, have a sexual charge of one kind or another.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that the movement argued very seriously, particularly in the 1950s and 1960s, that it couldn't. It simply wouldn't, and it couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that the movement changed necessarily the way people think about nudism on French beaches. It did, however, obviously have a very serious impact in the actual practices. So, I'm paying attention to the movement because, you know, I've written the book, but I continue to also be amazed at the number of people when I talk about the book who proceed to then tell me about an experience that they had in France. You know, they were driving along and all of a sudden these people were on a beach. Or, you know, they went along the Coast d'Aquitaine and discovered that there are a whole series of nude beaches. And, you know, I ask follow-up questions, but often I'm nodding like, well, yeah, I mean, that's the reality. The movement certainly was successful in arguing that there ought to be, as this German in 1963 put it, an approach of live and let live on French beaches. And, you know, that, of course, still doesn't characterize those very small and dense beaches that are the norm on the Côte d'Azur. But for anybody, you know, I know you're on the West Coast, and for anybody who's been in Aquitaine, it reminds you of the beaches that are kind of from Northern California and Oregon and Washington and on up, that are these, you know, they can be expansive. In the case of Oregon, these expansive beaches with very much a sort of live and let live approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
And given the arguments I've seen about the use of Aquitaine beaches in the 1960s and 1970s in the paper trail, that wasn't always the case. There are very definitely kind of a sense, there is a sense today in France that, you know, what's it hurting? And there are, we now know, codes that then get established on those beaches. So there's certain places that if there are going to be, you know, meeting places, lieu de rencontre, that tends to be in the dunes and away from the easily accessible ones, which is where the families are. And people kind of self-segregate according to how they're going to use that beach.
Uh-huh.
So that's what I mean by people imposing their own rules. Certainly today in France, and, you know, it didn't just come from the nudist movement. We could, again, look at publicité and the way people talk about bodies. But certainly the 21st century sees very exposed bodies in France in a commercial context and along beaches.
Well, Steve, I've taken up a lot of your time, but I just have one last question, which is, what are you working on now?
I've got a couple of projects. I'm finishing up a little sort of general interest book that I hope will also be used as a textbook on the history of rubber. And I know that doesn't sound like it's probably very connected to this book, but it's actually connected to an earlier book I wrote about Michelin.
Mm-hmm.
And in teaching world history, which I've done for several years now, I've really wanted to look at a commodity that allows me to talk about similarities in how labor was treated, issues of race, issues of gender, issues of class, assumptions about resistance in the form of labor movements in both areas of the so-called non-West and in Europe and the United States, so that I could allow students to see the interconnectedness of the world. And this little book that I've just finished, I think will allow me to do that. And I hope other people like it too. In terms of research projects regarding France, which is probably what most of your listeners would be more interested in, I've started a new book project, a couple of new book projects, but the one I think I'm really going to focus on now involves the Côte d'Azur and Nice in particular, to track what I call Mediterranean migrations. And I really love that book by Julia Clancy Smith about, it's really Europeans in Tunisia. And I'd like to track both elite and popular migrations into the Côte d'Azur and the what's often called the making of the French Riviera. Mm. And usually by that, you know, they're referring to these imagined identities that come through tourism. And yeah, you know, a lot of American writers and musicians, of course, did. Europeans went and imagined identities. And these are always these sort of touristic, free-floating, not very tethered identities. But, you know, the people who really built the Côte d'Azur were immigrants. They were Italians, above all. And after World War II, a lot of North Africans. And I'd really like to have kind of one place where I'm analyzing these different migrants, these different people who are coming together, and how they saw themselves and how they saw each other, in order to describe something something a little bit bigger. I'm really sort of dissatisfied with chunks of the not really the history of tourism, but sort of tourism studies, because of that sort of the set of free-floating assumptions, you know, people kind of, they imagine this and they imagine that. And in fact, there are very close connections and identities of self and identities that are being projected on other people that I think that this particular study will allow me to explore.
Well, those both sound like really fantastic projects, and I'll look forward to seeing them come out and perhaps discussing them with you in once they're out in new book form. Steve, I just want to thank you so much for joining me and for writing this wonderful book.
Thank you so much for the interviewing me today, Roxanne. It's been a real pleasure.